dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The main portion of our show this week features a speech recently given at Cornell by Palestinian peace activist Professor Hanan Ashrawi on the prospects for peace between Palestinians and Israelis. Also, an interview from jail with anarchist organizer Jaggi Singh, who was kidnapped by undercover police from the streets of Quebec City.
I never took food from the widows and orphans, and never a hard-working man I oppressed.
On our program last week on the FTAA protests, we reported that Jaggi Singh, a Montreal-based activist with the CLAC, had been denied bail and was being held in jail indefinitely. Jaggi was among the speakers who traveled through Ithaca and Syracuse with an informational caravan in advance of the FTAA summit. Jaggi is known throughout Canada as a spokesperson for the anarchist perspective on social issues and has frequently been interviewed there on television and radio as well as print media. CKUT of Montreal spoke with him in prison last week via phone.
And on the line with us from Orsainville in Quebec City, Orsainville Jail in Quebec City, we've got Jaggi Singh. Hi, Jaggi.
Hi, Jean-François. Hi, Monique.
Hi, Jaggi.
We've got Stéphane Christophe here and Alexis also.
Great. Hello, Stéphane. Hello, Alexis.
Hi. How's it going?
Well, I'm dealing with the situation. Obviously, I was disappointed, disgusted, actually, by the decision to deny me bail that happened last week, but I'm dealing with the situation and learning to cope with being here. And one thing that I really appreciated is all the help that people have tried to provide from outside, the support. That's been really cool. And I happen to be in a cell block with the five members of Jeminat, so we have lots of interesting political discussions, that's for sure.
For our listeners who don't know what happened to you on the 20th of April, maybe you can just go through a very short description of what happened.
Well, essentially, I participated in the march from Laval University organized by CLAC and CASA to downtown Quebec, but I stayed towards the back. The police and the prosecution are trying to make me out to be the street general, that I gave the order to attack and I gave the order to retreat, which is just nonsense. I had a megaphone. I was towards the back, and I'm sorry, there's some noise here. I was towards the back, and I had a megaphone, but basically I was giving speeches to people on the street and what have you. When the tear gas came and when the water cannons came, I decided to leave, and I went to Saint-Jean Street, which was one of the green zones, a safe area. And it was there that I basically got abducted by undercover police who weren't identified as police at all, and quite violently took me to the ground and stuffed me into an unmarked car and drove me away. That's essentially what happened to me on the 20th. And I'm being charged with possession of an arm, a weapon, namely a catapult, which launched teddy bears, and also participation in a riot, and also a breach of my bail conditions from Westmount, which say that I have to leave demonstrations that are non-peaceable. And I'm also going to be charged this coming week with a further charge, which is a breach of my bail conditions from the G20. Basically, I participated in demonstrations, and that's now being held against me, even though I've never really been accused of ever committing a violent act. And for all those reasons, and because of a judge who really wasn't listening, I'm going to have to spend at least a couple of months in jail, if not longer, waiting for trial.
This isn't the first time you've been abducted. I mean, we everybody's been talking about before what happened to you at APEC in Vancouver in 1997. Was this kind of the same way that they did it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, It was a little bit more isolated when it happened in Vancouver, but it got captured on video, which is why people could believe what I had to say. Otherwise, it would have been unbelievable. In this case, it was a little bit less isolated because I was talking to friends and I was just literally tackled to the ground and thrown into a car, but it was the same. And what is also the same is that the police are lying about what happened. The police officer in question testified that they read me my rights, and they said they were police and what have you. It's just a big tissue of lies, essentially.
How safe did you feel in Quebec City? Like, you were there all week, and I remember you were talking to me and saying nobody should ever leave me. You should always be walking with somebody else. And
well, everybody should, in terms, especially people who are in organizing roles. You know, so I don't want to make it out it was just me, but people in organizing roles should, you know, buddy up. So I was always buddied up. You know, for example, when I moved from René-Lévesque Boulevard towards Saint-Jean Street, I was looking for somebody who could walk down with me, because this could happen at any time, or just getting harassed by the cops is possible. So, yeah, I buddied up with somebody. The police are actually testifying that I had this army of bodyguards around me at all times, which is just another little lie, but there you go. But, I had suspicions, and the conditions from Westmount and G20 put people, put me at least, in a very ambiguous position, right? Because it gives them the opportunity to determine when a demonstration is peaceable or not peaceable. Mm-hmm. I left the demonstration, which technically would allow me to abide by the conditions, but of course the police disagree with that, and in the meantime I gotta wait in jail until it goes to trial.
How are you being treated, Jaggy, and how do you feel about these realities that have come down upon people like you?
Well, it's jail, it's prison actually, and it's not great. The food's not great. Your liberties are denied. You don't go outside very often. There's all the variety of things that are used to wear people down. That's being applied. I managed to get my hands on a pen and paper and do some writing. I can make collect calls outside during certain hours, so I'm doing that. I managed to get I managed to get my voice heard a little bit on the outside, like right now. So it's a mixed bag. Obviously, I would prefer not to be here. In terms of the situation, I look at it as an extension of the security measures. We saw before the summit in Quebec City a fear campaign and talk about all kinds of different weapons the police might use. During the summit, we saw the fence. We saw 6,000, 7,000 police, lots of tear gas, rubber bullets. That was a level of repression, but it didn't simply end on the 22nd or the 23rd of April. It continues, and one way it continues is using legal means to repress, using legal intimidation. And this is one example. Denying bail is quite a serious matter. It's usually done in serious situations, and they're applying it to my case, despite the fact that I have no violent record or what have you. So it's just a ratcheting up of the repressive measures, the repressive techniques of the state, and it's something that people should learn from, and I hope people don't get intimidated, and if anything, get that much more outraged and that much more inspired to be more active. And certainly for me personally, I'm just itching to get out to do exactly that.
What exactly are your plans now in terms of trying to get an appeal, or what would be the solutions for you to get out of jail as soon as possible? What are you working on right now?
Well, there's three levels. One is personal level, the second is political, and the third is the legal level. On a personal level, I'm just trying to get habituated and get into a routine here. Trying to establish visits, trying to establish getting books. That's one thing that's really a real punishment, not having books. Books of your own choice. There's a lot of trash novels you can pick up, I guess, when the little library comes through. But so that a personal level, I'm just trying to get established here. On a political level, it's to put pressure, public pressure, through a variety of means. From what I understand, there was a vigil outside the prison. There have been demonstrations in Europe, in New Zealand, in the United States, and in Canada, both in Montreal, in Toronto, and Windsor. And that political pressure is very, very important, that the authorities here understand that people are watching and that it's an outrage and people know what's going on, not just in my case, but in the case of the five people from Germinal as well. And then the legal dimension is that We're having a date this coming week to determine the orientation of the preliminary inquiry and trial. So I'm preparing for the trial and the inquiry. I'm looking forward to defending myself and collecting witnesses and all that. But also, there is an appeal of the bail decision. And that's going to take time though, because it has to go to the Quebec Superior Court. And I have a friend of the court who basically is handling all the legal questions, Pascal Escarbeau, and he's currently working on that. And in his words, the decision of the judge was just astounding. It was incredible. The way in which he sort of ignored the presumption of innocence, because the conditions that apply to me from G20 and Westmount are for things that I've yet to be found guilty of. They're still working their way through the courts. And secondly, the way in which Judy Rebick's testimony, she came to testify on my behalf, was totally misrepresented by the judge. So on the legal level, preparing for trial and also trying to have an appeal done. But there doesn't look like, there's a really, really small chance that I could get out within very soon. It looks like I'm going to have to sit tight for a few months and miss out on the spring and summer that everyone's been waiting for, including myself.
So you're saying that you could be in jail until maybe September?
Potentially. Depends on the scheduling of trials and that, all of that. I'll have a better idea after this coming Thursday. One thing to keep in mind is that the court sessions are much less frequent during the summers because it's spring and summer and the judges and lawyers like to go on vacations while prisoners have to languish in prison. So that's one thing that's working against me, and we'll really see on the third. But absolutely, it could be the entire summer, which is a couple of months.
Right. How about in the situation in jail? How have the cops been treating you? Is there intimidation happening on a personal level when you deal with prison guards or police?
Well, it's prison guards in here. Mm-hmm. Initially, and this is something people should keep in mind, there were a lot of abuses for the the 400 or so people who were in here. A lot of people were here on bogus, really bogus charges. People who hadn't seen a lawyer, 5, 6 people cramped to a cell. A lot of intimidation, a lot of abuses in that way, even though this jail was supposed to be emptied out so as to enable them to process people effectively. So keep that in mind. There are abuses to everybody. In terms of me, they're just minor level stuff. I mean, not getting proper meals and all of that. But it hasn't been so bad. I can't say it's been horrible or anything. It's just prison and you don't like it. But I mean, it's Quebec City prison with guards who, absolutely don't share the mentality that I do. You get comments like, where you're from, why don't you go back to your own country, all that stuff, but that's not a surprise here.
And how about the jail? Is it starting to fill up with the
all the regulars region? Are returning. The jail's filling up really quickly. The cell block that I'm in is all full. I happen to be with the prisoners from Germinal, the 5 people who still rest in prison who were arrested before the summit. I should say a note about that. Once their case is able to be fully explained publicly, I think people will be shocked at the way the police and the media acted in their case. It's not what the media and the police are making it out to be. And their continued imprisonment is also really unjust. I'm not their spokesperson. They have people on the outside. Maybe after the show, when I have a chance to talk to you guys, I can give you some contacts in case you want to talk about it on your show. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they'd be open to that, and they have a lot of friends and supporters on the outside. But my cell block is basically filled up, and it's fine. Prisoners are returning, and prison's settling into its usual routine.
What do you see for the future of the movement that you are yourself involved in, and really build the FTA protests?
Well, I don't want to be a prophet or anything and give some sort of blueprint. But one thing I think it's important is that people, we anticipated this, various people who were active in various groups in Montreal, such as CLAC, anticipated, the repressive measures. I recall giving, a couple of workshops on police repression and surveillance of activists. I think people just have to be able to confront this increasing level of repression from solid ground, not to be intimidated. That would be the worst, because the police mentality is that, look, if we can put somebody away, we can show that radicals are evil and criminal and what have you, and they'll go to jail, they'll be inconvenienced, we can even lie and get away with it, and they can do nothing about it. That could really have a devastating impact on people's morale and sort of, say to them, they might say to themselves, well, it's not worth it getting involved. And I hope that doesn't happen. So I think people have to respond that way. One thing I've told people when I've talked to them on the phone is that I think the next 10 years will be really interesting. I mean, there are a lot of critiques. I mean, Stefan, you know, you've been to some of the talks I've given, like in Toronto and Ottawa and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've always talked about how we have to avoid the summit hopping dynamic and try to build locally. And I know that a lot of activists in Montreal, especially who are congregated around the CLAC, like in the weeks leading up to the summit, we're kind of, let's just get this over with, because there's so many local projects that we want to start diving into, like independent radio, say, or community radio, but specifically on social housing issues, on immigrant rights issues. Really, I mean, we learned a lot and made a lot of contacts with people and, learned a lot of things, learned a lot of useful skills, learned to evaluate what's realistic and what's not realistic in any given situation. Those are all really useful skills that you only can get through experience and what have you. And a lot of people were like, let's get it over with, take a little bit of time to recuperate, definitely support political prisoners or anyone else who's in jail, still be active on globalization, absolutely, but apply those things locally. And I hope that happens, and I hope that happens in a real militant, radical way.
Jaggy, I know you weren't there on Saturday in Quebec City, but what were your thoughts on the events in Quebec City in terms of the people who came and the amount of people who came and what happened on that day, Friday?
Well, on Friday, a conservative estimate of how many people were there is about 8,000 to 10,000. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Mm-hmm.
But 8,000 to 10,000 to me is an astounding number of people for mobilization that was clearly opposed to the FTAA and the summit and was ready to try to disrupt it to the maximum extent possible. That's an excellent number. I mean, in Seattle, keep in mind that while there were 50,000 to 60,000 people on the streets, maybe only a few thousand of those were actually involved in the direct actions. And then, of course, on Saturday, you had a lot more people. One thing that really struck me was how people just kept on returning to the perimeter. And despite the way the media and the police make it out, it wasn't the Casas. I mean, you can't account for every single individual act in a crowd of 10,000 people or in a crowd of 50,000 people or in a crowd of whatever. But what struck me was how people just kept on coming back, how those people were from all walks of life. There were local people in Quebec City who took to the barricades and got politicized, who were helping out people who were getting gassed, union people, a significant amount of whom left the union march to go to the perimeter. The perimeter became a real tangible symbol, a tangible example of what was wrong, and people just kept returning to it, and they didn't need orders, and they didn't need any group to tell them so. I was also struck by the fact that groups came organized, autonomous. You know, obviously a lot of things could have been done better, but that was something that struck me. A lot of the courage of people, and I don't want to overstate things. I mean, you know, courage can be expressed in different ways, can be shown in different ways, not just during a demonstration. A lot of people don't have the luxury of or the privilege of going to demonstrations, but for those people that were there, there was a lot of courageousness in terms of confronting the amount of repression and responding. And also, I wasn't there. Obviously, I was nabbed by Friday afternoon, but from talking to people on the phone and trying to evaluate things, it seems to me that a lot of the reactions to the police were spontaneous and local. People locally responding, people who are victims day to day of police brutality. I recall one friend of mine telling me that, you know, in Saint-Roch, there were prostitutes there kind of directing traffic away from where all the stuff was going on, while people were confronting the police. So on a variety of levels, I think it was good. And obviously, those of us who are involved in organizing capacities can see deficiencies or what have you. But, we managed, despite the border being shut down, despite the fear campaign, despite all of that, to have significant numbers of people in Quebec City with a significantly radical message. And I think a lot of people learned a lot and got inspired. And I think the real test is how that's applied in the upcoming months and years.
All right. I think that's all the time we have for this morning. I'm going to make a proposition, Jaggy. How about you call us every Monday to tell us what's happening?
All right. Well, hopefully I can phone, not always from prison. I'm hoping I can get out soon enough. But, yeah, as long as I'm here, I'll try. The phone only opens up at 8:30, and there's all kinds of things that happen in the morning that that might keep me away. But I'll definitely phone if you guys are doing the show every morning. It's one thing I regret not doing between January and April was I used to do your show a lot as a part-time host or whatever, and mm-hmm. never got to. So maybe I'll arrange some of my own interviews and stuff. And,
now you've got all this free time.
Yeah.
Or unfree.
Unfree time, yeah. It seems like free time, but it's funny how the time passes just doing nothing. Mm. Yeah. I'm trying to keep myself busy, though.
I'll keep your spirits up.
Yeah. I'll keep them up.
Mm. All right. Take care, Jaggy.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for being with us.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jaggy.
See ya. Bye.
Bye. That was Jaggy Singh speaking to us from Orsayville Prison, north of Quebec City. His trial comes up. I think, not his trial, the date for his trial is going to be coming up this Thursday. The judge decides when the trial is going to be taking place.
The sole judge.
Yeah, one of the worst judges in Quebec City, apparently. And doesn't look too great for Jaggy Singh. I think he might be in for a few weeks, maybe a month, maybe.
Maybe he can organize some stuff in prison.
Well, that's what
we're working on stuff too, right?
Outside like
pressure and
I know, but he will radicalize the prisoners
on May 1st. Yeah,
say okay, go home.
On May 1st, he's organizing a debate. Anarchy,
you curate a riot in jail.
Anarchy versus communism with people from Germinal, and they're going to debate that within the prison walls. That should be interesting.
Avis à la population, au pays de l'empereur, tomate au ketchup. Les enfants sont droits et ils font la loi. Pour les cotis, pour les cotons. C'est l'année zéro de la rébellion.
That was Jaggy Singh speaking with reporters from CKUT, a community radio station in Montreal. In his interview, Jaggy mentioned being told by prison guards to go back to his country. To clarify, Jaggy was born and raised in Canada and graduated from the University of Toronto, but Jaggy is a child of immigrants from India. Canadian authorities, especially those in Francophone Quebec, are hostile to Asian immigrants who they blame for the failure of the referendum on Quebec's separation from Canada. French-speaking Québécois suffered second-class citizenship at the hands of Anglophone Canadians for hundreds of years, until they rose up during the 1970s in an often armed conflict. French Canadians were the earlier inhabitants as a result of French colonization of the Americas. When the English won possession of Canada from the French prior to the American Revolution, the Francophone colonists began their centuries-long struggle to retain their language and culture in Quebec. This explains the hostility directed specifically at immigrants in Quebec who don't view Anglophone Canadians as occupiers and oppressors in the way that French Canadians do. Immigrants from Asia, because of their dark skin, are readily identifiable and have been targeted by Quebecois nationalists, many of whom populate the police forces there. I'm going to read you an account of the treatment meted out by Quebec police to Toronto community broadcaster Dexter X during the summit. The report does not say it, but Dexter X is also of Indian descent. In an email to a friend, on Saturday, April 20th, Dexter was among a crowd of people sitting in front of CMAC, the independent media center in Quebec City, which had been set up to cover events from the summit. Suddenly, police charged down the stairs from the street above, Côte d'Abraham, down to the media center, and assaulted a crowd that was relaxing in front of the building, firing rubber bullets and enveloping the entire residential neighborhood in clouds of gas. We were there. Dexter wrote, I was accompanying an elderly gentleman up the stairs by the media center to warn police that they were tear-gassing a baby when the officers in full riot gear grabbed me and started bashing my face against an iron grid and concrete wall. They beat me, choked me, and stomped on me. Then they dragged me across Côte d'Abraham, hit me between two cars, and beat me again. Officer Jean-Yves Gagnon, number 5018, yelled at me, "Parlez français ici, Osti. Go back to your country. Go back to your country. C'est mon pays, pas ton pays," which means, "It's my country, not your country." I was kept in prison for 2 nights with no water and no medical attention. They served us rotten milk for breakfast after starving us. I was intimidated and harassed whenever I tried to assert my rights. They pulled my hair to take photos of me. They hung up the phone when I tried to call my lawyer. They threatened to keep me in jail for 6 months or release me alone in the middle of the night if I didn't cooperate. I was simply working as an independent journalist reporting for a local radio station, Radio Basse-Ville in Quebec City, CKLN in Toronto, and CMAX webcast Radio des Amériques. And that was a report to a friend from Dexter X on his brutalization by the police in Quebec City. The issue of ethnic identity runs through the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as well. Though right-wing Jewish fundamentalists have come to the forefront in the conflict as settlers in the occupied territories, the formation of the modern state of Israel was spearheaded by largely secular Zionists who were seeking to establish a modern social democracy where Jews would not be a minority group. This accounted for the expulsion of the Palestinians from the state of Israel and remains a barrier to peace. Though Islamic fundamentalists have become prominent on the Palestinian side in recent years, the original resistance movement, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, was also a secular leftist movement for self-determination, and our next speaker, Hanan Ashrawi, comes from this Palestinian tradition. In a real sense, Christian European racism and anti-Semitism lies at the root of the conflict. Jews in Europe experienced treatment in many countries similar to that of African Americans in the Jim Crow South. The Nazi Holocaust was a culmination of centuries of ill treatment of Jews by European Christians. It's important to understand that the Jewish victims of these policies had lived in the countries in question for centuries, much as African Americans have lived in the U.S. longer than most of the whites who have been accorded a superior class of citizenship. Israel's founders wanted a democracy, but one where Jews could feel safe from oppression by remaining the majority population. In her talk, Ashrawi mentions a conversation with an Israeli who says that Israeli mistrust of Palestinians is influenced by a sense of guilt for the brutalization visited upon them, the knowledge that they have done the unforgivable. In this sense, there is a parallel in the white fear of blacks in the U.S. Though it is the blacks who are in fact brutalized and largely defenseless, white fear reflects this same dynamic of eventual retribution for unspeakable injustice visited upon a people. Hanan Ashrawi.
Judging by the size of you, the audience, our speaker actually needs little introduction to the Cornell community. Dr. Hanan Ashrawi received a PhD from the University of Virginia. She established and chaired the Department of English Literature at Birzeit University, where she's also served as Dean of the Faculty of Arts, taught and published widely on Palestinian culture, literature, and politics. More recently, she authored, among a number of books, This Side of Peace, A Personal Account, won a seat on the Palestinian Legislative Council for the Jerusalem District, and, of course, engaged in numerous activist initiatives on behalf of democracy, human rights, and feminist concerns in Palestinian society. And she has joined Israelis in dialogue and in various social and political ventures of interest to the two peoples. Dr. Ashrawi, of course, is widely known by both her many admirers and her many interlocutors as an articulate, passionate, and uncompromising advocate for Palestinian national rights and political independence. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, who will speak to us this evening on peace, current crisis, and future prospects.
Thank you, and it's wonderful to be here again, 6 years later. Many things have changed, and I'm always grateful to be in an academic setting. This somehow it satisfies my frustrated urge to teach, and it's something that I haven't been doing for the last few years since reality intrudes. There was an Arab summit, I don't know if you've seen it on television, and I looked at all these men, heads of state, ministers, and so on. And when I was asked to comment on this, on the Arab summit, the first thing I said was, first of all, where's the other half of our society? There wasn't a single woman in the Arab summit. And two, I said, how many of them had come to their positions as a result of free and fair elections? And since we all lament this global crisis in leadership, I'm very proud to say that I see here, particularly in Rebecca and your group, a promise that this global crisis will not persist, that we do have promise for a better future and for genuine leadership, leadership that's willing to work and to intervene and to make a difference. So thank you. And I also would like to thank the long list of sponsors and volunteers. I think if all of the sponsors and volunteers are here, this hall would have been filled. So I guess I thank you all for your effort to bring me here. And as usual, I mean, coming to this part of the world is somehow leaving a different world. It's not easy to be here, and I'm one of the very few people who can actually leave Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza, given the fact that we are still in a state of multiple siege, the fact that there is still daily shelling and shooting, that helicopter gunships, whether Cobra or Apache, are still hovering overhead, that people don't feel safe in their own homes, and they cannot move much beyond their homes. It certainly is situation that's very difficult to leave behind. And even though I do leave it behind, I carry it with me wherever I go, because I feel I have been entrusted with the narrative of a whole people, a whole nation, a nation that is in captivity, whose only fault is the fact that it is determined to be free, to live in freedom and integrity on its own land. A nation who's guilty of refusing to succumb, of refusing to accept a state of injustice and oppression. And when I come here, I also bring with me always the names, the identities of people who are killed, and I always refuse to talk about them as numbers. That's why I don't recite numbers. Or of people who were wounded and injured or permanently impaired. But I feel that at one point or another in our history, we have to stop using superlatives for the Palestinians. We have to say, when I come here and I say we have the largest refugee population in the world, or ours is the longest standing military occupation in history, or the only remaining military occupation in the 21st century. Sooner or later, we should be able to discuss ourselves, our case, our history, our narrative in normal tones, probably even in boring tones, but to constantly have to struggle against forces of history, to pit yourself against also some of the strongest powers in the world these days, is not easy for a nation that feels entirely defenseless. However, the one thing that we do have is the determination and the commitment to a life with integrity, with freedom, and with decency. And I must say that we will not abandon hope, and we will not succumb to injustice, and we will not be pounded into submission, and we will not die in silence. This is the message I'm bringing. And to those of you who have read this, those who are distributing it, may I just tell them that it's always good, for the sake of academic integrity, if nothing else, to check your facts. And two, as a literature teacher, I would really like to see some creativity and originality. I've read these things before at Binghamton, right? So I think it's good if you start looking for something that is, you know, remotely related to the truth on the one hand, and slightly more original and creative on the other. Then I will respond. We are witnessing these days a tragedy of violence on the rampage, violence unleashed, and not just abstract violence or anonymous violence. We can identify it, and we know why it's there. And it is much more acute now because of the dashed hopes for peace and justice and for freedom. I remember when we started the peace process, even before 91 and the Madrid peace process in 1988, 89, and it was then also a Bush administration. I said, don't you meddle, don't you dare meddle, don't you start raising people's hopes unless you have the full intentions and commitment to see this task to its conclusion. The worst thing you can do is make a promise to people, and a promise of peace, which is one of the highest and noblest pursuits, and then not follow through on it. And right now we are seeing ourselves in a period of tremendous letdown and pain, as opposed to the confidence, the exuberance, the high expectations of 10 years ago when we launched the Madrid peace process. Buttressed by confidence in the Intifada as a people who have resisted occupation, as a people who have not internalized the mentality or the ethos of defeat, but people who said, since our will is not broken, that we have dared to resist, and therefore we have the courage and the strength to reach out even to our occupier and to make a bid for peace. Unfortunately, all this will to intervene, to change the course of history, to transform realities, to create a new paradigm, to replace the existing paradigm of perpetual conflict, did not actually produce results for a variety of reasons. We are still in this, what I described then as this fatal proximity, this abnormal reality of occupier and occupied. And we've always said that in order to create normal relationships in our region, we have to live next to each other as good neighbors, not on top of each other as oppressor and oppressed. But in order to change that paradigm, you have to change mentalities and attitudes. And of course, you have to replace the logic of war and violence and domination and threat with the logic of peace, of parity, and of empowerment. Now, of course, you know that parallel with the peace process, we started a nation-building process, which wasn't easy because ours is a nation whose very existence has been denied, whose normal development has been disrupted, who's been subjected to the dual injustice of dispossession, dispersion, exile, refugee status on the one hand, and occupation and oppression and deprivation of every type of freedom on the other hand. And in order to try to put together the pieces of the shattered nation, we had to take the initiative ourselves, and we had to learn from other people's mistakes rather than repeating them. And I've always described the Palestinians as a people who have been baptized by fire. And therefore, we are not easily intimidated, particularly when it comes to the pursuit of a just peace. But at the same time, we still had to fight against the convenient labels, the stereotypes, the processed language, the spin machines, the distortions that have dominated the discourse when it comes to Palestinians. It's as if the Palestinians have become the only legitimate targets, not just for verbal malignment and distortions and racism, but also for actual physical oppression and violence. When we started the peace process, we started it from a point of strength, as I said, with a peace agenda that was lucid and simple and compelling. We didn't have any hidden agendas. We said our objective was ending the occupation, the devolution of occupation, the evolution of statehood. We wanted to end the state of injustice, of occupation, and create instead a Palestinian state. In order to redeem the past, we had to move towards a future that is based on not just coexistence, but on a recognition of peace, as I said, as a value, based on legality and justice. And this peace would be capable of launching a new era in the whole region. Thus, it's important to understand the magnitude of the historical compromise we made when we accepted UN resolutions 242 and 338. We accepted those in 1988, because before that, the Palestinian people felt that there was this historical injustice, that our very history, our very reality was denied and negated, that more than half the Palestinians became refugees, and therefore we had a claim to all of Palestine. 242 and 338 dealt only with the 67 war, and therefore with 22% of historical Palestine. And it wasn't easy to gain a constituency for peace, to accept the fact that 22% of Palestine is the land we're talking about, to build a Palestinian state that can be viable and that can be an active player in the region as a force for democracy, for change, for development, for human rights, of course, and rule of law. And to do that, it took a lot of persuasion to get a constituency that would accept that. And you cannot make peace in a vacuum or in an abstract. And we did. We said there are basic essential requirements for peace to have not just a constituency, but longevity and the possibility of producing real changes in the region. All of the territory occupied in 67 had to be returned to the Palestinians. We're not even talking about 181 and the partition of Palestine. The Palestinian refugees' right of return has to be recognized. Israel has to recognize its culpability and acknowledge its guilt. And then we will move from there, having set the historical record straight, in order to find a solution for the Palestinian refugee question on the basis of UN Resolution 194 and the right of return. Of course, when we talk about 242 and the 67 territories, the 22% of Palestine, we also include Jerusalem. We never dealt with Jerusalem as a separate issue. Jerusalem is part and parcel of the Palestinian land. It is a Palestinian city. And since both East and West Jerusalem are governed still by UN Resolution 181 that describes them as corpus separatum, there is no sovereignty over Jerusalem. To change that status, there has to be an agreement to share both sides of the city and create an open city. But you cannot create a mythical Jerusalem, a celestial Jerusalem, or even a fragmented Jerusalem, neighborhoods and holy sites. What you have to do is deal with it from the point of view of legality within the political solution as part of the occupied territory. Now, we also maintained that any agreement has to be based on international law, and that once we accepted 242-338 as the applicable UN resolutions and 194 for the refugees, that we have to accept the fact that the international humanitarian law prevails, particularly the Fourth Geneva Convention, de jure, not just de facto. And we felt that this was our only anchor, that the only way in which you can have a genuine peace and a peace that would last is if it is firmly embedded in UN resolutions. And we started a peace process that was based on a gradual approach, confidence-building measures, leveling the playing field, beginning the removal of the occupation in order to negotiate permanent status issues from conditions that are more conducive to just agreements. So what went wrong and why are we here now? Why are we still talking about the loss of life, about shelling and bombing, things that I haven't seen for decades, even though I lived most of my adult life under occupation? What's happening? Why has the peace process become a punitive process for the Palestinians? Why has it allowed for continuing unilateral actions and collective punitive measures? Of course, when we talk about unilateral actions, this is a euphemism for things like illegal actions and provocative actions, such as building more settlements, confiscating more lands, changing the character of Jerusalem, taking steps and actions that would prejudge the outcome of permanent status issues. So very benign terms like unilateral actions really have very destructive content and substance and impact on reality. Because the peace process also had no accountability for the occupier and no protection for the occupied. Wherever we turned, we were either slapped with a veto, as happened, of course, with the latest Security Council resolution about international protection and international troops. We heard then that they said it wasn't necessary nor practical. And to me, what is more necessary and practical than saving human lives? This is certainly an international responsibility. So if you allow power politics to prevail, and if you allow the asymmetry in power, the disequilibrium in power, to take hold of the peace process, then you have this lethal formula of Israel being a country above the law and the Palestinians being excluded from the protection of the law, and you have totally distorted the global rule of law. If individuals are equal before the law, then states have to be held equal before international law. And this hasn't happened yet, primarily because we have one sponsor, the U.S., at that time. The U.S. brought its strategic alliance with Israel to bear on the peace process. It took sides, allowing for the exploitation of the weakness of one side, using pressure in order to reinvent the peace process constantly in order to suit Israeli priorities, and putting pressure on the Palestinian leadership, linking their fate with the peace process to the point where they reached the level of self-negation almost. Again, another flaw was the fact that the gradual approach that we accepted was non-incremental. It didn't have a self-sustaining momentum. Israel maneuvered itself in a position to decide at each step what to implement, what not to implement, and the Palestinian leadership was placed on probation or on good behavior. And of course, the process became fragmented, and it adopted the mentality of fragmentation, both of the people and of the land, including also the fragmentation of the region. Those of you who followed this peace process understood that with the previous administration, the last two terms, 8 years, the main focus of the region was what's good for Israel within the strategic alliance, and the peace process itself was extracted from its natural context, which is the region, and whether it can be a force for change and forging new relationships, stable and peaceful relationships in the region. Now we're getting exactly the opposite. We're getting a new administration that says, well, let's look at the whole region and let's ignore the peace process. Let's look at where there is funding and oil and business opportunities, and let's keep our distance from the Palestinian reality. And what they do, in a sense, is give Israel room to inflict more pain and punishment on the Palestinians. It's, if I may be simplistic, I'll use this analogy. It's like seeing, you know, a bully beating a helpless child, or seeing an abusive husband beating his wife and saying, well, why don't you stop the violence? Or I'm not going to interfere until you two, you know, settle your own problems. Well, there's no symmetry of power, and you cannot keep your distance. And sometimes it is your responsibility to intervene. I mean, it's like saying also you may use any other stick, but not the stick that I gave to you, because the Americans said you cannot use the Cobra and Apache helicopters or American weapons to destroy Palestinian homes or to shell Palestinians or to carry out the assassinations. So it's like it's not the fact of the assassinations and extrajudicial killings that is horrible. It's the fact that it's American weapons that are being used that is horrible to the American administration. There's something strange there. It's not the fact that you can shell whole neighborhoods and terrorize people day and night. It's the fact that it's been done with American Apache or Cobra gunships that bothers the administration. But somehow there has to be accountability there. And of course, along with the fragmentation of the people, the land and the region, we also have the adoption of the functional rather than the territorial approach. In 1982, Israel, for many years, since 67, tried to create a whole system of quislings or collaborator systems. And of course it failed. I think ours is the only occupation that did not develop a collaborator culture or mentality. Even with the village leagues, it failed. So in 1982, people like Menachem Milson and others called us and said, well, why don't you, we have no interest in running your own lives. We are willing to give you all the administrative tasks to run your own schools and hospitals and, you know, collect your own garbage and things like that. We just want to have the overall control. And we said we are not in the business of working as employees of the occupation. And we are not in the business of becoming your functional collaborators. What we want is the end of the occupation, control of our land, our own freedom, and then we can take care of our schools and hospitals and collect our own garbage. So now they try to transform the peace process into this functional process. And you've heard this repeatedly, and now you hear it again, by saying that we have no interest in running Palestinian lives. Well, fine, then leave the Palestinian land. We don't want you to run our lives, and we don't want you to be on our own land. But you cannot say you can have your functional responsibilities, you can run your own lives while we take away your land, build more settlements, control your crossing points, steal your water, demolish your homes, kill your children. That's okay, provided you can run your own lives. It's not going to happen. And since the signing of the Declaration of Principles in 1993, with this beautiful ceremony on the White House lawn, not a single agreement, we've had a series of subsequent agreements, not a single one of them was fully implemented, and not a single timetable was fully honored. Not one. And the process was constantly being reinvented. Every signed agreement was reopened for renegotiations, and I can give you tens, if not hundreds, of examples. So that led to the destruction of the integrity of the process itself, and of course robbed it of its substance and of its applicability. And of course, without arbitration, without intervention, it became almost meaningless, except as an exercise in power. But to the American peace team then, the process was the objective. It was the most important thing. I don't know this American obsession with process. To me, a process is a mechanism, is a means, is a tool to get somewhere. To Dennis Ross, so long as there's a process, God's in his heaven, all's well with the world. You know, just get the people to talk, that's fine, regardless of what's happening on the ground, regardless of what they're talking about, whether they apply the signed agreements, or whether they behave in a way which is consistent with the requirements of peace. So the process became an end unto itself. It expanded to fill the whole space, and it was being micromanaged by people who had their own agendas. And they made no bones about it. I mean, Dennis lately said how the greatest success was to maintain the process while the settlement process was still ongoing. And when you consider that the basis of the talks, of the process, was the land for peace equation, you're taking away the land, so you're destroying any validity for not just the process, but the peace that is supposed to be produced at the end of the process. Another problem with this constantly renegotiated, reinvented process was that it had a negative and adverse impact on our own realities. It distorted Palestinian realities. There were many pressures and obligations that the Palestinian Authority was supposed to do, including things like preventing incitement, which was a very polite term for the exercise of censorship, things like preventing cracking down on the opposition, which is another not very polite term for violating political freedoms and freedom of expression. So we ended up with an internal distortion in the nation-building process where we had to see the suspension of due process and the rule of law, the violation of human rights, political rights, and the exercise of deliberate control to the point where we ended up with state security courts and military courts. And of course, we had the proliferation of security systems. But all these led to, again, an internal situation, conditions that were not entirely conducive, let's say, to democracy or to stability or to internal confidence. And I've always maintained only the strong can make peace, and your strength comes from your own internal cohesiveness, respect for the law, and respect for the human dimension and for human rights. It doesn't come from any kind of approval from outside sources, be they the Americans or the Israelis. And this led to the weakening of the standing and credibility of the Palestinian leadership. In addition, there was a total disregard of Arab and Palestinian public opinion, as though we don't exist. All you need to do is create a process, personalize it, deal with individuals. It doesn't matter what you do to the people because you have a leadership that can somehow browbeat or convince the people to accept any agreement, even though it might violate their own rights. This disregard is a very disregard of public opinion is very consistent with the sort of what Edward Said would call the Orientalist approach to our part of the world, which is a racist way of assuming that the whole world, the whole Arab world, particularly the Third World, is made up of one-man shows. And all you need to do is cater to the ego of that one man, to the power of that one man, to the interests of that one man, and of course, his clique. I'm not saying her, notice, because we don't have women in these positions. And then you can get them to sign anything, and they will shove it down the throats of their own people. They didn't understand that Palestinian and Arab public opinion is active, vibrant, and lively. And that if there is no peaceful transition to democracy, there might be a violent transition to democracy. And there has to be this transition. And the only way you can have any agreement that can lay claim to permanence or legitimacy is if you pay attention to the people's voice. And this very simplistic mantra of, Israel is the only democracy in the world. Well, I can tell you otherwise, in the region, I'm sorry. They might think they're the only democracy in the world. There's no democracy that can occupy other people and rob them of their humanity and still call itself a democracy. There's no democracy.
Tune to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, and WXXE Truxton. You're listening to a talk by Palestinian peace activist Professor Hanan Ashrawi.